Welcome to The Source, powered by WHYY News and Billy Penn. This collection of stories from the WHYY Newsroom offers fresh insights into the neighborhoods and local communities across the Philadelphia region. From Center City to the Pennsylvania suburbs, South Jersey, and Delaware, get to know the issues and the people that make your community tick. This is The Source. I'm your host, Kenny Cooper. People with drug addictions living on the street in Kensington and other Philadelphia neighborhoods often have serious health issues that make it hard for them to find a shelter that will accept them. A program launched by Project Home aims to bridge that gap. The initiative seeks to help people who frequently end up in emergency rooms move into places that can accommodate their needs. The belief is that this can stabilize their lives and allow them to focus on getting better. Mayor Rindy with WHYY's BillyPenn.com has the details.
4 years ago, Joey Essinger was doing pretty well. He'd gotten sober after using heroin for years and had a good job as a contractor, installing plumbing and drywall and the like.
I was doing so good. I'm not a material person, but like I had a lot of material things. I was making good money, sitting on his money saved.
But he says he was still an addict, and it wasn't hard to go back to using again.
Because sometimes the addicts, when we're really down and you know, we go through things that are tough emotionally, we get high, and sometimes we're doing so great that, like, you know, it's like I deserve to get high. And that's kind of like where I was doing so good.
Essinger said he decided to use heroin just once, and then a second time, and soon he was using daily again. He spent all his rent money and ended up living on the street near Amtrak's 30th Street station. Madison Schmoos, who was a nurse at nearby Penn Presbyterian Hospital, often saw him come into the emergency room.
At least three times a month he would be there for, like, I would say more so minor things, right? But just because you didn't have a place to go.
I was trying to getting off the street.
Yeah, even just like a bed to sleep in or like his foot hurt.
In December 2024, Essinger did a stint in drug treatment. The day he got out, he got high again and took a bad fall at a SEPTA station that left him with a shattered right heel. After 2 weeks at Jefferson Hospital, he was released in a wheelchair back onto the streets. Soon after, he had a drug-related seizure and was taken to Penn Presbyterian again, where Schmoos and a medical case manager asked if he was interested in moving to a shelter.
I was like, oh my God, I could not believe it. Like, I hugged them both right then in my hospital bed.
The previous year, Project Home had received a $25 million donation to create a collaborative program with the hospital systems at Penn, Jefferson, and Temple Universities. It aims to provide places to live for people like Essinger, whose intensive medical needs means most shelters can't accommodate them. They end up bouncing between emergency rooms, short stays in recovery housing, and the street. Gilly Gary is a project manager at Penn Medicine.
If you're, for example, in a wheelchair, there's very limited options to access recovery centered housing. Or if someone, is on methadone, it's really hard to access a skilled nursing facility, or someone doesn't have a dedicated dialysis chair. There's just so many barriers.
Essinger got a spot in a dorm-style room at Project Home's Sacred Heart Recovery Residence in North Philadelphia. He got a cell phone and Uber rides to methadone treatment and weekly medical appointments. When he goes to the doctor, Schmoos comes along to lend support and help him explain how he's been doing. Rosa Friedman, a Penn Medicine case manager, said part of the job also involves translating medical talk, so patients can understand their conditions and their next steps.
I like to kind of be there to be a second brain and second set of ears, both to help them remember what they wanted to address. And then afterwards, you know, I've had people kind of turn to me after an appointment and be like, so I kind of blacked out. I didn't absorb anything the doctor said. And so just kind of being there to be able to remind people what happened.
It took nearly 4 months of hard work, but Joey Essinger learned to walk again, got sober, and is on a waiting list for permanent housing. He says he's looking forward to getting his own place and eventually finding a new job.
I can't wait to get back to work. I'm going to start off easy, maybe like 20 hours a week, something small. You know, I don't want to stress myself out. Like, and I'm not doing any more labor. I'm an old man now, but I'll find something that's good for me.
For BillyPenn.com, I'm Mayor Rindy, WHYY News.
Grocery stores typically have shopping carts that can fit a toddler, or even carts that look like race cars, where small kids can ride along. There are also motorized scooters for people with mobility issues. But there's also another type of shopping cart, one that disability advocates say should be more widely available. WHYY's Alan Yu explains.
Yeah, so we can make some oranges. Yeah. Let's get this so that we can some oranges.
I meet Constance Jones, a mother in her 30s, at a ShopRite supermarket in Northeast Philadelphia. Jones says she used to dread grocery shopping. Her 7-year-old son, Austin, is on the autism spectrum. And last year, he had to stay in a hospital because of a genetic condition and struggled to walk after he came home.
A couple times a week, if he's doing a lot of walking and he's complaining about it, I don't want to be upset with him as a parent just because he's in some sort of pain or he's going through something that I don't know about.
Jones either had to find someone to take care of Austin while she goes grocery shopping, or she had to find a shopping cart that would fit her 7-year-old son. Austin no longer fits in the toddler seat, and having him sit in the main compartment meant very limited space for groceries. So Jones would look for a special type of shopping cart called a Caroline's cart. It has a large seat in the back, facing the person pushing the cart.
You could put your groceries in the front. You don't have to break your back to pick your child up to put, you know, your kid in the middle of the cart.
There's a seat belt to secure the person in the seat.
As you see, I didn't have to do anything. He just sat down. He's buckling himself up. When we get in there, he's going to be comfortable.
The cart can fit people who weigh up to 250 pounds. It's intended for older children with special needs or even adults.
Oh, it's a lifesaver. The moment I see these carts, I'm like, thank God.
Jones says there are some grocery stores in the area, like this ShopRite, that have a Caroline's cart. But they're not always easy to find, and parents and caregivers who need them may not know if a shop has one or not.
So I want other parents to be able to know that this exists in these stores. They can request them if they need them, and not to feel ashamed to have to use it, because sometimes it's a little embarrassing when it already feels like we have to ask for help to even use them.
Drew Ann Long, the founder and creator of the cart, says this is a problem around the country. Caroline's carts are not always as accessible as they should be.
You don't hide the funny parts. You don't hide the electric scooters. Why the heck are you keeping Caroline's cart in the storage room?
The cart is named after her daughter Caroline, who was born with a disability and inspired Long to make the cart. Long says that even though Caroline's carts have been around for more than a decade now, she is still working to get more stores to buy them for customers.
I created a product that the consumer wanted, but the consumer couldn't buy it.
2 years ago, Walmart announced that all stores in several states in the South and Southwest will all have Caroline's carts. Target said most of their stores have at least one. Here in our region, Giant said in a statement that the company introduced Caroline's carts a few years ago, and they remain available today. Wakefern, the parent company of ShopRite and Fresh Grocer, did not respond to a request for comment. There continue to be efforts to expand access to these carts. A few months ago, The Arc, a nationwide advocacy organization, for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, said every Caroline's Card in the country will have a sticker showing the organization's logo and a QR code that people can scan to request more cards in their local stores. Alan Yu, WHYY News.
The sound of the pesky, annoying horsefly warns us all. Stay still or you might get bit. But even more destructive is a particular silent fly that arrived on our shores about 250 years ago, around the same time Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. As part of our series on the anniversary of the nation's signature document, WHYY's senior climate reporter, Susan Phillips, reports on how one of the country's first invasive species spurred suspicions of biological warfare, threatened the nation's economy, and inspired citizen science.
We're going back to 1776. In August of that year, thousands of German soldiers known as Hessians arrived in America to fight against the Continental Army. Paid by the British, the Hessians sparked fear and resentment among the colonists, helping to rally more Americans to the cause. These soldiers were so hated, they were named as one of 27 grievances listed in the Declaration of Independence, condemned for raping and pillaging farmers throughout New Jersey. Around the same time, a new pest began to eat wheat, barley, and rye crops on American farms. The pest was a tiny white worm, sort of like a maggot, which munched its way to adulthood, destroying the harvest before flying off to mate in other fields.
It began in Long Island and Brooklyn, and they could sit and watch as the insect moved further west and further south.
Lou Mazur is a professor of American history at Rutgers University. Mazur says the fly, which is the size of a gnat, worried farmers, many of whom, like Thomas Jefferson, were also delegates to the Continental Congress.
They are concerned, deeply concerned, because wheat is critical, not only to domestic production, but to export.
Rumors spread that the fly hitched a ride, some thought on purpose, through the straw bedding of Hessian soldiers. While it could have happened this way, there is no evidence this is how the fly arrived or that it was a piece of biological warfare employed by the Hessians or the British. But the story stuck. After the war, a gentleman farmer and slave owner from Princeton, New Jersey, named George Morgan, looked out over his devastated crops and decided the pest needed a name. In fact, a very bad name. Morgan explains here in a letter that he wanted everyone to associate the destruction and violence by Hessian soldiers with the devastation wrought by the fly.
The name of the Hessian fly was given to this insect by myself. We agreed to use some industry in spreading the name to add, if possible, to the detestation in which the human and insect were generally held by our yeomanry, and to hand it down with all possible infamy to the next generation as a useful national prejudice.
So it's a very powerful piece of rhetorical propaganda out of the rage that the revolutionaries felt of those 30,000 Hessian soldiers who fought for the British during the war.
Morgan also wrote to George Washington that year telling him the fly had reached Philadelphia. He describes in detail his experiments to save his crop. That same year, Britain banned wheat imports from our young nation because of the Hessian fly. Thomas Jefferson was furious, calling it a libel on our wheat and saying it was in retaliation for America winning the war. Jefferson soon got involved as a member of the American Philosophical Society, which spearheaded scientific research into the Hessian fly. The society, created by Benjamin Franklin in 1743, still exists today in a faux colonial building near Independence Mall.
Let's see what I have here.
It's here where millions of colonial-era documents are stored.
So I want to show you two, just so you can see. These are the official APS minutes
from 1787 to 1793.
Audriana Link is the History of Science curator at the American Philosophical Society. She opens a sheepskin-bound volume with elaborate handwritten cursive script on parchment.
These are really incredible accounts that represent the conversations that would have been happening at the society during the time. So here, this is an entry from April 15th, 1791. On motion of Mr. Jefferson, resolved that a select committee be appointed to collect and communicate to the society materials for forming the natural history of the insect usually called the Hessian fly.
In 1791, Jefferson and James Madison set out on an expedition. Traveling through New Jersey and New York to survey farmers, they asked these ordinary Americans to observe and document their experiences with the Hessian fly, which threatened the new nation's economy. While they didn't get the amount of responses they expected, Link says their attempts at citizen science was a uniquely American, as opposed to British, way to solve the problem.
So that, I think, is distinct, too. There's this kind of optimism in the power of collective scientific work.
Link says Jefferson's obsession with the fly was twofold: serious risks to the nation's budding independent economy, and pride that American science, or what was then referred to as natural history, could be just as effective as European.
I think Jefferson being sort of the driving force in this is telling, because he did see science as being a mechanism through which to build the nation.
By 1811, the Hessian fly had traveled south to Thomas Jefferson's fields at Monticello, destroying one-third of his wheat crop. Today, the consensus is the fly was never even in Germany. The Hessian fly originated in the Fertile Crescent in North Africa and the Middle East, the same place where wheat originated. And today, it's still here. The pest is manageable, but still one of the most devastating to the country's wheat. The tiny larvae emerge at the base of the plant several times a year, and in some areas of the country, climate change could be making it worse. The solutions today aren't that different than they were 250 years ago. Find and develop more resistant strains of wheat, and time fall planting to avoid egg laying. Almost 250 years later, everyone, scientists and farmers alike, still call it the Hessian fly. So the Princeton farmer George Morgan would be happy to know that he succeeded in passing down his
useful national prejudice.
From the Climate Desk, I'm Susan Phillips, WHYY News.
Delaware launched a program in 2023 to remove lead paint from homes where children poisoned by the toxic chemical live. But WHYY's Chris Barish reports that the state can't keep pace with the need.
Delaware's Division of Public Health has overseen the remediation of 30 homes at a cost of $4 million. And there's only enough money left in the abatement account to remove or contain the lead threat at about 50 more homes. Meanwhile, more than 550 kids under the age of 6 were confirmed in 2023 and 2024 alone to have elevated lead levels in their blood. That means they likely have irreversible brain damage, which could plague them with lower IQs, developmental delays, and behavioral problems well into adulthood. No poisoning figures have been calculated for 2025, but Amy Rowe of Lead Free Delaware says state leaders need to allocate more money and act with greater urgency.
This is just a drop in the bucket. There could be thousands of homes or even more that are requiring lead-based paint hazards to be addressed, and we've only done 30 through the state program.
Lead paint is by far the leading cause of lead poisoning in children. While the federal government banned the manufacture of lead paint in 1978 for residential uses, about 42% of Delaware's houses and apartments were built before then. Nicole Topper runs the remediation program for public health. She agrees the situation is serious.
So we've been building and ramping up the program. We are in full operations right now, but there takes some time into building up a program. From inception, things are moving and the procurement processes, contracts are all now in place.
Governor Matt Meyer has proposed a $2 million cash infusion to the program, But Dr. Jonathan Miller of Nemours Children's Hospital near Wilmington says that's not enough to address the dire situation. Miller has joined Roe and other child advocates in urging $15 million more in funding.
There's an urgent need because the longer we wait, the more children will get poisoned. So the quicker that we can remediate homes that have lead in it, the less children long-term are going to get poisoned.
Rose succeeded Miller as chair of the state's Lead Poisoning Prevention Advisory Committee.
This problem will only continue to pile up until we address it. Lead does not go away on its own. It does not just degrade into nothingness. It will continue to poison children forever until the sources of exposure are properly remediated.
Last year, lawmakers also mandated that all rental homes built before 1978 be assessed for lead paint starting in 2028, and if lead paint, flakes, or dust are present, that the hazard be removed. From the Delaware Desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
When you think of whiskey, places like Scotland, Ireland, or even Tennessee or Kentucky may come to mind. But Pennsylvania has a rich whiskey tradition, especially for rye whiskey. WHYY's Zoe Reed reports whiskey lovers are trying to put Pennsylvania back on the map.
A pungent and sour scent greeted me at the entrance of Dad's Hat Rye Whiskey Distillery in Bristol, Pennsylvania. Founder Herman Mihalich walked me through the former textile mill. Now his farm-to-bottle operation.
Here's where we start. Hanging over here is a bag that held yesterday 1 ton of grain from.
Mihalich uses rye, locally grown in Bucks County. It takes at least 3 gallons of water to make every gallon of whiskey.
We start with grinding the grain, and then we mix it with hot water to cook the grain. That's the mashing process, and that happens in that tank over there.
The enzymes in the mold break down the starch into sugars and convert it into alcohol. The rye bubbled away in the fermenter. Mihalich's distillery sits along the Delaware River, which is rich in limestone. He says that makes local water perfect for whiskey making. The mineral content helps keep yeast healthy and is typically low in iron content.
It's as good as any mineral water you've ever had, because when we first started, we actually tested the local water and found it to be excellent in terms of its hardness. So that limestone and the rock formations we're standing over contribute in a really positive way to the quality of the water we're using.
The name Dad's Hat is a nod to Mihalich's father, who loved wearing fedoras. The whiskey connoisseur owned a family bar that Mihalich's grandfather opened after Prohibition. Decades later, Mihalich opened Dad's Hat in 2011 to bring rye whiskey back to Pennsylvania. Rye whiskey was actually born in the state, partly because of grain production. Local historian Laura Field says after the U.S. gained its independence, there was a cultural and economic shift away from British identity.
Post-Revolutionary War, you had this rejection of rum and molasses and British products. So American-made products, namely rye whiskey, stood out as almost a patriotic thing to drink.
By the late 1800s, Pennsylvania had a whiskey boom. There's even a reference to its rye whiskey in the novel Moby Dick. So what makes Pennsylvania rye stand out? Local whiskey writer Lou Bryson describes its distinct herbal and spicy notes.
You'll get a whiskey that has more of the rye character, and depending on the yeast you use, that can either come out as a clovey spiciness. It usually comes out with some grassy notes, might be minty, but it's a much more herbal, spicy character than most bourbons.
Prohibition led to the death of the whiskey industry in the state, but today, Pennsylvania whiskey is making a comeback with craft distilleries like Dad's Hat and others.
We're hoping that by promoting the Pennsylvania rye style as a category, we'll help everybody in our business in Pennsylvania.
Whiskey lovers are now calling for set standards for Pennsylvania rye whiskey to help the state reclaim the spirit. Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
Finally, we head to Paul's and Grace Ferry, where the Philadelphia Animal Welfare Society is the city's largest rescue partner. It provides services across the city that helps ensure animals have homes and pet families have support. In a typical year, PAWS impacts about 40,000 lives through rescue work, shelter services, adoption, foster care, veterinary clinics, pet pantry, rehoming services, and other resources. WHYY News photojournalist Kim Painter helps us rediscover more about this Philly neighborhood staple as part of BillyPenn.com's City Guide.
PAWS is Philadelphia's largest rescue partner, and we are working to make Philadelphia a place where every savable pet in the city has a home, and also where every pet owner has the support they need to keep their pets as part of their families. I'm Melissa Levy. I'm the executive director of PAWS, the Philadelphia Animal Welfare Society, and I'm very proud to have been doing this for nearly 20 years. In a typical year, PAWS will touch about 40,000 lives. We do that through the animals that we rescue, through our shelter side of things, providing adoption and foster care. That number is typically around 2,500 animals a year. We see well over 25,000 animals a year through both of our veterinary clinics. And then we serve thousands more through our support services, our pet pantry, our rehoming services, our temporary foster care, lots of other ways that we support the community. So this is Churro, and Churro is a pretty typical case. Churro was found alone in North Philadelphia and was picked up by a police officer and brought to the city shelter. And pretty short time later, our team met her there and felt that we would be able to find her a wonderful home. When you see us talking about an animal who needs a home or a need for supplies or a fundraising campaign that we're doing to provide medical care to animals we're rescuing, it's any effort to get that message in front of new people and inspire them to join us can make a difference and can save a life. I cannot imagine a more fulfilling way to spend my days, and we have really created and built a community that I think we all feel very, very proud of and very moved by, and to get to do that on a day in and day out basis is pretty lucky.
Thanks for joining us for The Source, powered by WHYY News and Billy Penn. We leave you with a Billy Pennism, a bit of wit and wisdom from Pennsylvania's founder, William Penn.
If you protect a man from folly, you will soon have a nation of fools.
The Source Podcast is a production of WHYY News. I'm your host, Kenny Cooper. Our executive producer is Sarah Glover, WHYY's Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Our editor is Mark Eichmann, WHYY's News Director. Alan Tu is the audio editor. Our engineers are Charlie Kyer and Al Banks. Funding for this podcast has been provided by WHYY and the Linfest Institute for Journalism. Please rate and review this content wherever you get your podcast and share on social media. Visit WHYY.org for more news stories. Thank you for listening and engaging.